It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beachtree Studios.
Well, that's not what it is, so let me I can't believe I did that. Hold on a sec, let me play the right...
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Tuesday. It's January 22. It's cold, but sunny, and it's winter, let's face it. And today it's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. This is Westchester on the Level. My name is Hezzy Eris, and our first guest already online is Robert Keston. He's going to open up the broadcast. We're going to talk to him about the changing demeanor. To some extent, we're not exactly sure which way it's going to go, but there are different dogmas being expressed on the Democratic side of the political perspective, and we're going to explore what that means and the importance of paying attention to it. So good morning, Mr. Keston. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Well, I'm very excited about what's going on in the Democratic Party. I don't know if it's similarly happening on the Republican side of the equation. They seem to be under attack because they don't know. They're losing a lot of strength, whereas the Democrats are really blossoming and they've really changed the demeanor of the discourse. But part of that demeanor that's changed is being promoted by people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So this is a young individual, evidently learned, and but she's hooked on to something that is really resonating across the political spectrum, and that is that we need to get greater taxation capacity from our entire populace, because she's suggesting that the people who are very well-to-do are not paying their fair share. And that's been proven to be the case based on the system that we have now. Is her concept credible? It is seemingly on the economic perspective, but is it credible politically?
Anytime you talk about raising taxes, it is a difficult thing because Americans, by and large, don't want to pay taxes. We do not
right.
have the same mentality as people in other parts of the world where the expectation is that you pay something in and government and social services will take care of the rest. We have this notion that everybody pulls themselves up from their own bootstraps, even though it's a falsity. We still believe
yes.
in that kind of rugged individualism that never really truly existed as much in reality as in fantasy. But you know, she also couches what she says cleverly with, this is what it was under a Republican president, namely Eisenhower, and all that came before him. So it's hard for Republicans to argue, because Eisenhower had one of the most peaceful presidencies, the one that gave us interstate highways, the one that gave us the really burgeoning growth in the middle class. We really became a middle-class society. So it's hard to argue conclusively that that wasn't one of the great periods, at least for white America, in American history. So when she talks about that 70% taxes on people making $1 million or more a year, it becomes very hard to argue.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing that's compelling. A lot of people in economics and will corroborate that her thinking is correct. There's someone that used to be in Harvard, an economist, Sumner is his last name. I never cared for his expression of thought in the past. He suggested that she's right on target and that we need to go in that direction. But that's really the question. It makes it sound like the only issue is, 70% return on from those people who earn $10 million or more per any given year. But doesn't the question that she brings up ask how do we want to define the American society into the future, because we claimed it was one thing, which it proved not to be over time. And like you said, it really served the white America more than it served anybody else. And so how do we redefine, or how do we begin the engagement of discussion to define what America wants of itself?
That's quite a difficult question, because different parts of America really want different things for America. Although I think that when you get down to the brass tacks, most people want the same things for themselves and their families. They just don't necessarily want anybody else to have it too. And I think that until we come to an agreement that there is a baseline where everybody is equal and everybody starts from that same position of what is a necessity to have the kind of life we all aim for in the United States, that discussion is going to be very difficult to have. So it goes back to our conversation of 2 weeks ago, the fundamentals of human rights. If you use that as your cornerstone, if you use that as your baseline, then you can come to some kind of an agreement. But you have to agree that there is a line of demarcation that you do not cross. And the United States isn't there yet. And unfortunately, as we saw in the Revolution, as we saw in the Civil War, as we saw in the 60s and early 70s, the United States has to hit a rock bottom place before people are willing to have the free dialogue that's necessary to move us forward. And right now we're caught somewhere in between. We can see the divides, but it seems much more difficult for us to see the commonality. And that in part is because it's so much easier to take people down than to build people up. And so we even see it now as candidates declare themselves for the presidency. We see armies of people going after them. We're not even listening to what they're saying. We're looking at what they said 10 years ago or 15 years ago. We're not listening to them now. People change. We accept that change in ourselves. We're a little bit more reluctant to accept that change in other people.
Well, that's the thing. Do we really I guess some people believe that everyone has a right to the simplistic aspect of what we want from life, you know, the ability to raise our children so that they're educated, have a capacity to earn a living, and thereby also have a capacity to build a relationship and have children, whether straight or gay, because you can always adopt children as well, or have a surrogate to give you a child. The bottom line is that we thought that was the basis for everyone's in agreement, and everyone says that, but like you said, it's for me, but not for somebody else. What is the fear if we allow everyone to have the education that's required to earn a good living? And why, therefore, do we permit corporate America to define for us that we're not deserving of that? Because they're not engaging us as much.
Well, I don't think it's that corporate America isn't interested in an educated electorate. Culturally, Americans believe if someone gets something, then I'm not getting it. Or why should I pay for someone else to get something when they should be paying for it themselves? And we don't often understand or study history in a way that gives us answers to those questions. And without the appropriate answer, without an answer based on fact and not fiction or supposition, we really don't come to the right conclusions. So if you go back in American history, all those hundreds of years of slavery, it was outlawed to teach a slave to read or write because the planters, the masters, understood that an educated force would be a much more dangerous force. If they could read, if they could write, if they could communicate with expansive language that would put their owners at risk. And that mentality has continued even today, where the wealthier school districts or the wealthier communities within a school district often complain that they're helping or bolstering districts other than their own, or children in the district other than their own, with the same educational benefits that their children get. And of course, it doesn't really make sense, because when all boats float, the entire society does better. And there's that old expression, one bad apple spoils the whole bunch. So why would you want there to be one bad apple? Because that one bad apple will hurt your children, or hurt you, or hurt the economy, or hurt your community more than if all the boats are floating. So it's really hard to understand, but you can see it in Westchester County as well as any place else. The example of the Mount Kisco Elementary School. There are other towns in the Bedford Central School District that are wealthier than Mount Kisco in toto. And they complain that their school taxes are as high as they are simply to sustain the Mount Kisco Elementary School. That is, one, it's not good community work. Two, it's probably not a good education for the community from the Board of Education to let them understand why and what and where that money is being used and how. And I think they're coming to that, but it has taken a long time. And in that long time, you get sides that become very rigid in how they feel. And that hurts everybody, and it certainly hurts children. And the more children that we hurt, the more dangerous society becomes later on, when those children who do not have opportunities because they didn't get the education they needed grow up and become adults who don't see the prospects of a bright future.
Yeah.
So you expand upon that nationally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Well, I was going to ask, wasn't there a time in America that maybe was in the 50s, where other people paid for children's education? The investment was made, and it was from that that begot children, let's say, of my age, which is like 70, and yet at the same time, you ended up having a need to repeat that. But people of my age, the baby boomer generation, I'm at the older end of it, but the bottom line is, though, that we succeeded to a great extent, but maybe we became worried about others. Why aren't we interested in making the same investment that was made for us? Have we forgotten that, or does it not matter to us anymore? Mm-hmm. Because our children also are not being as successful as we are, which is an unusual history.
It's certainly unusual for the United States. Absolutely. Every generation, by and large, has done better than the generation before it economically and socially and culturally.
Mm-hmm.
But what has happened is that pool has gotten much bigger. So the United States, when you were a child, was still predominantly white. And over time, that the white population as a total percentage of the population has dropped, and people fear people who are different than themselves. When you look at the United States, it is stronger because of that diversity. But as change happens, people are frightened by change, and they're frightened by differences, and they're frightened by what they feel is a loss of what was theirs or what is theirs. And they don't want it taken away, even though the enhancement in the long run is far better than what they started with. So, you know, a couple generations ago, ketchup was the number one condiment, and now it's salsa. So salsa, I hate to say, is a lot better tasting and probably a lot healthier than ketchup was. So
right.
That is really an example in a very silly sort of way of why diversity, why differences within our cultures and society actually make us stronger and healthier. But it's hard for people to accept those changes while they're happening because it upsets their apple cart. And they are afraid that they will lose their place in the pecking order. And like I said before, you know, you saw it in Civil War times. Poor whites who had absolutely nothing were still afraid of liberating the slaves because they thought that they would have even less. The reality was, and the reality still is today, that when you float those ships, everybody rises together. When you sink one ship, those people start to pull down the others. So poor Southern whites ended up doing better simply because people were then being paid for work. Freedom is freedom, and freedom breeds freedom, and that is good for democracy. So everybody did better in the United States when the Emancipation Proclamation and later amendments to the Constitution made it that slavery was totally illegal. And in today's world, as we look at it, the welcoming, not always in a positive way, but ultimately, of the Irish and the Jews and the Chinese and the Germans added great value to the United States and its ability to be competitive in the global marketplace. And now with Latin Americans and Africans and more Asians coming in, that probably, if history is any guide, will enhance the United States' role in the world as the world becomes more and more competitive and in many ways smaller and smaller.
So where's the failing? Maybe our forgetfulness, because we choose to forget, so we don't remember how it worked. Some of us are too young to have a historical perspective, others are not. So the ones that should be responsible are those that have a memory or have studied, so know how it used to work and why it worked and who paid for it overall. So, and even economists are saying, well, if you dampen down the remuneration that people are offered, you also you put a kibosh on voter turnout. You diminish people's prospects in life. Isn't there someone at fault here? Is it media that's at fault? Is it the politicians who don't explain what's going on well enough that is at fault? Or do we have, you know, people who want to, be just talking heads, but they have an agenda that's really built on fear as well? And why can't we convince the nation that even though there are different sections of the nation, that all these realities are baseline, they function, they've been proven, they're all economic, they have a return? So why haven't we done that?
It is easier to scare people and it is easier to play on people's fears than it is to give them enough information for them to be enlightened. And those who often seek power, whether in office or out of office. The NRA is a good example. The Ku Klux Klan was a good example. The so-called Tea Party is an example of creating fear. But the other side of the aisle does it too. You know, the more fear, the more anger, the more hostility that is created, the more power is centralized in the status quo and establishment. And the establishment, no matter where that establishment is, whether it's in office or out of office or in corporate worlds or in religious institutions, they do not want to give up their power. And it is so much easier to scare people to stand behind you than it is to give people the tools they need to lead the way into the future for themselves and their families.
So Is American society then fragmenting that we're not getting a good enough response from Democrats or a good enough response from Republicans and all the other less large political parties, conservative and green and a million and one other names? Are we going to get to the point where a third party will evidently rear its head that can coalesce a lot of these issues into one dogma? Or are we very, very far removed from that? Maybe because there is no real interest to go there and everyone's in fear.
Well, third parties in the United States have not often been successful,
no.
But it certainly is true that leading parties have died and other parties have come and replace them. I mean, the Republican Party is only from the mid-1800s, and Lincoln was its first president. So since then, of course, there have just been Democrats and Republicans. Democrats are a little bit older, but at one time it was the Democratic Republicans or Republican Democrats, and they were one party, and it ultimately became the Democratic Party. And at one time, the Democrats were the party of the South, and the Republicans were the party of the North.
Up until even
the 1960s, I mean, maybe even 70s, with people like Rockefeller and Javits, Republicans were far more, I think I'm going to use it anyway, progressive than many of the leading Democrats, who were Southern racists. And as that membership switched, and Democrats became more progressive and Republicans became more tied to corporate America and more regressive, that's when we saw the changes in tax codes. That's when we saw the changes in how society treated other members of society. So I don't know if the evolution will come from parties per se, but it will come from the next generation of leaders like an Ocasio, who grew up with a lot less prejudice. I know that with my own kids who are in their 20s, that they don't really see a color barrier, and they don't really think in terms of race or ethnicity or gender as a way of moving forward. So I think that there's a lot more of that in the upcoming generations, and that's something that scares a lot of older people, you know, that where do they see this freedom? Where do they see this equality? And what is it going to do to our positions and our place and our jobs and our this and our that? And it will change. And the United States has always, no matter how difficult it has been, moved forward. So although we may take a couple of steps back, what we see in Washington now and in other governments around this country is the last stand of the old white Christian male, most exemplified by Donald Trump, trying to hold on to power, clawing with all their might and corporate support to hold power that is not theirs. It belongs to the American people. And eventually the American people will reassert themselves and take that power back. And I don't think that it's the party that does it, it's the people that do it. And the party that best appeals to that sense that it is about people over politics, that's the party that will ultimately win this battle. I think we saw it in 2018, certainly in New York and in many other parts of the country, certainly in the House of Representatives, which is the people's house more than the Senate. We saw that Democrats were speaking the language of more people and thus have a nice majority, not only in the United States House of Representatives, but in the New York State Senate and Assembly, and in a growing number of other places across the country. And until Republicans wake up and start not just being populists, but being populists and responding to what people need and want and demand, the Republican Party will continue to shrink as it has over the last 2, 4, 6 years.
Well, if that's the case, and it seems to be that the Republican Party is waning, because it's not connecting with the majority, because this president, President Trump, was elected by only a few thousand votes. So there were electoral votes that he was able to win. And but that's neither here nor there. That was our system then and continues to be. But the question is, will either party, Republicans or Democrats, Democrats or Republicans, allow the other to inculcate a greater proportion of the populace under their umbrella? Is that conceivable, or are we just so recalcitrant that we won't allow anybody to move beyond their political placement right now, even though the Democrats have gotten the upper hand, for example, in New York state politics, and there's a bevy of new legislation that has been promoted by the Democrats and the Democratic Conference leadership. So how does this work out, or are we still unaware of where it's going to go?
Once again, if you look at history, we know that it will go forward. We don't know what the timing is. But we always face hurdles in the present that were not even thought of in the past. And that was because we had to worry about more mundane things. So if you go back to, you know, the American Revolution, women had to wash all their clothes by hand, and they had to make all their meals from scratch. And men had to go out and really do work. If you were a farmer, you were farming. You didn't have tractors and you didn't have all those other things. And as technology moved up, it gave people more time. And with time, women said, well, we want the vote. And ultimately enough men agreed that women should get the vote and freed the slaves. And then we started talking about reproductive rights and LGBTQ rights and all of these things that we couldn't even consider when we were just worrying about basic survival, hunger, cold. Now we have central heating and central air. That gives us that much more energy and capacity to worry about things like the environment and being green. Of course, we may be a little late to that game. I'm hoping that we're not, but we're not yet dealing with all the changes that have already taken place in climate and weather. And we have to move quickly on that, but we can think about it because we have the luxury of time and capacity that we didn't have before. So as we move, the kinds of things that are being addressed in the Assembly and the Senate, and hopefully very shortly the governor will start signing some of this into law, because passing bills is wonderful, but until they are law, they are somewhat meaningless. And hopefully the health and mental health care committees in both chambers will start moving on single payer or universal or whatever you want to call it, health care plan, which would really move New York to the forefront of leadership in the United States in terms of addressing the needs of people and not just conforming to worrying about bank accounts and wealthy donors.
So at the way it looks now, for example, the way it works is we have discussion, we have sensibilities. Eventually it leads to legislation being passed or being promoted, and then it does require, for example, the governor to sign off on these bills so they become law, and then it's the law that catapults us to the next step? Is that the way really the process works and functions?
Well, it all depends. I mean, in many instances, laws follow the will of the people. Lincoln was a great exemplar of that, where he tried not to let the law go too quickly ahead, because he knew that the backfire would be worse than the pressure to get there. I think that what is being passed in Albany, what has reluctantly been passed in Washington, often is where the will of the people, the tipping point, already has is there or has already passed. So laws regarding voting rights, laws regarding LGBTQ rights, laws, I believe today the houses will both pass Reproductive Health Act. We're already there. We're already past there. There are millions of people who support these issues, this legislation, way beyond the tipping point. So there's no problem with those being signed. Healthcare, a single payer, Medicare for all, those kinds of things are much more controversial at the local level. And so, therefore, we're not necessarily there yet. But there is certainly a groundswell for a change in healthcare policy in the United States. Why the United States has fallen behind so much of the rest of the world is hard to understand in reality. But the fact is we are behind the vast majority of industrialized countries, if not all industrialized countries around the world. And it's time for us to catch up and once again assume some kind of leadership in that arena as well. We need to really focus on long-term education, whereas we used to be able to teach the things that were constant. You know, if you worked at IBM or Ford or General Motors, at one time you could expect a career for life, and that is long gone. So how – not that our educational system is failing. We still have great schools, public schools at every level. But mentality of getting people to understand that education is now lifelong is still something that our schools might not be doing and our legislators might not be understanding to the level that they should.
Boy, very compelling. Always, every time we speak, I hope you're not bored by this subject. It is so compelling to me because I think it's the equation is being driven by trying to understand where we are individually and collectively. So I want to thank you for making the time as always, Mr. Keston. What a pleasure. Stay
warm.
Thank
you so much. I enjoy the conversation. Yes, you too. Have a good day.
Take care. Goodbye. Well, there we have it, folks. Robert Keston, a politician, at the same time also an advocate for progressive democratic concepts that are being formulated now and evidently look like they're going to be passed in the they passed by the Democratic Conference. We'll see if they get the governor's approval. We'll see where that drives the equation. And we're also looking at stuff on the national level where we have also different changes that we expect with the leadership in the House by Democrats. The Republicans still control the Senate. We'll see where that all goes. I see we've got Delphin Musler on the line. So good morning, Delphin. What a pleasure to have you on this morning.
Good morning. My absolute pleasure to always be on your show, Hezzy.
Well, mine as well, having you on the show, which is always great. We have to make you we'll blurt it out publicly, but we should make you our Wednesday co-host and Tuesday co-host because you'll be on Tuesday, and so we'll have to do that. And hopefully that'll sit well with you. Well, one thing I have to do is give you kudos because you broke the news with regard to Virginia Perez, who won re-election as a county legislator. I think it's the 17th district she represents. And but now we find out that she's not going to I think she's going to step down, or is she just going to finish her term, which is at the end of this year, isn't it?
Yes. This coming year she was supposed to be up for re-election, yes.
Okay, so she's not running.
No.
No, so and have you been able to conceptualize in your mind, or do you know of anybody that wants to run for the 17th district?
I think, well, there's been some rumors that Corazon Pineda, Isaac, was going to run for that seat. You know, they were going to put her up against Virginia. I don't know what happens now
if
she doesn't run.
Who's putting her up?
The talk was people like Chris Johnson and that kind of ilk.
Yeah, but you know, I'll be honest with you. You know, there are always ideas that are floated out there, but they also have to be pragmatic. And
that's true.
Right,
yes.
Now, that Corazon Pineda, she sits there in the second district representing the Yonkers City Council's second district. She earns one of the lowest pay, probably the one that's earning less now is Shanae Williams in the first district. But Corazon, when I last looked at what she was getting as a remuneration for being a city council person, was about $100,000, which includes pay, medical, health insurance, medical is health insurance, and a car, a city car, as well as reduced prices for gas. Plus, she just got a position working on the county. So she's able to be a council member in Yonkers, work as under the employ of Westchester County government. But if she decides to go and become a county legislator, she's going to reduce her salary to $57,000. She won't get a car. She won't get reduced cost. And then she will also lose her job. And I don't know what she's getting paid for the job in Westchester County. Why would anyone in their right mind
give
all this money as well as the ability to even run for a third term?
Yes, that's true. Absolutely.
It's
no,
not
it's totally
a step
true.
Up, is it?
No, it's not. I don't think it's a step up, to be honest. In fact, I think a lot of ways it could be a step down because, you know, she's making what she's making now. She's not going to make that she's not going to make that as a county legislator, plus the salary that she's making now in her job with the county. So, to me, I think it'd be better just for her to stay in her position that she's in now, and she keeps the county job, and that way she has the money that's coming in. But like I said, becoming a county legislator is less.
Well, besides the money issue, I mean, let's face it, we all contend with concerns about money. However, even if you eclipse that, it doesn't seem to me, in my mind, that one can be more relevant as a Westchester County board legislator than being a Yonkers City Council member. I don't see that as a step up. I see it as a step down, many, many rungs down. I don't know about you and how you look at them, but I'm sorry to say, even though I like Virginia Perez, I don't see what she's done for us in Yonkers, representing Yonkers. But let's not just go after her. There's Chris Johnson. I think he was lackluster as a city councilman, and he wanted out. That's why he permitted to get all that help so he could become a Westchester County Board legislator. But he wasn't effective. He's not effective as that now either.
I agree. Yeah, that's true.
Positions. They mean nothing. I mean, do they mean anything to you? Because they mean nothing to me.
Nothing really, to be honest. Nothing really, as far as I'm concerned. You know, just nothing. He's really done nothing. I actually agree with you. He's actually done the same stuff the county legislator as he was as a councilman. He was lackluster as a councilman. Now he's lackluster. Yeah, no, it's true.
Because there's no legacy accomplishment for Christopher Johnson. Some people like him because he's black. That to me is not the pigment of your skin is not a leg up one way or the other. It's not a leg down either. But I hold everyone with regard not to the color of their skin or their religion or their sexual orientation, but simply what the hell have you done for us lately? I thought that was their purpose. Representing
That's
us.
True. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true. Like you say, has staying a council member is more important than going to the county level, because you're on the county board of legislators, you're one of 17. At least on the city council, you're at least one of seven. I think even more of a voice on the city council.
Absolutely, because there's greater control within the city council, Yonkers City Council, to outcome as opposed to the control and management of those people on the Westchester County Board of Legislators who may succumb to whoever the power is, whether it be the former county board, county executive Astorino when he was in power. Now we've got George Latimer. He's the county executive. We also have a county, we also have a mayor in the city of Yonkers, but the balance between the executive branch of mayor as opposed to the city council being the legislative branch, I think it's a much more powerful and more balanced position than the 17 people trying to slug it out with the county board, with the county executive. So I think you
absolutely
were right on about that. Now, there's the other issue. Now that we are sure that Virginia Perez is not running for a re-election, who's going to try to get her job? Is it conceivable that London Reyes, who is going to want to attempt now, without her there, to try to get the minority seat that Virginia Perez is holding? Or are we going to get somebody else that's out there? Or is,
that's a good
or
question.
Is London more interested in becoming Corazon's successor or Sabatino's successor? They say that Sabatino is going to not seek re-election.
Wow. I don't know. It should be interesting to see who's going to fill Virginia's, the seat that Virginia has now. It'll be interesting to see. London ran 2 years ago, so I don't know. I guess we'll see what happens. Should be. Yes, that's true. And you know, another thing that's interesting also too is the process starts earlier this year, because by the state the legislature voting with the they've done, it's the petition process is no longer in June. What I was told yesterday, it's actually the end of next month. February 26th petitioning starts.
Absolutely.
Something you might have always been talking about, you know, as far as the election cycle starting earlier and people getting out there and be able to let their thoughts be known to the people. This is kind of good now, because these candidates come out earlier and we can let their feelings know, you know, what their thoughts on the issues, what their platforms are, let the people know what they are, so that at least the voters are more informed when they go and vote.
Well, assuming they inform us, you know, quite often.
That's also true, yes.
They don't say squat. You know, they're like they're hiding something. As you know, they want to represent us, but at the end, they don't want us to know who they are. So they don't want us really to know how they're going to represent us, which might be to be dismissive of us. But you know, so you know, it's like it's really hilarious the way this whole operation works. But one thing is for sure, the legislation is there, and it was passed. It now requires the actual vote of the signature of the governor. So if he signs it, then it will go all into place, and we begin that process on the 26th of February, as you rightfully pointed out. But isn't there also a convention that's going to need to be held sometime in the first 2 weeks of February prior to this?
They always have the conventions every year, you know, on the city level and also on the county level as well, because it's got some county, you know, obviously you've got the county legislative, all 17 county legislators up, and also probably some other judgeships and stuff like that. So they got to have the political calendar starts a lot earlier this year, which I think is a good thing, because then we can see who's running, and because a lot of people who you always talk about, wait until the absolute end to say they're running. At least with this fastening of a calendar, people have to be announcing quick what their plans are.
Well, it's put up or shut up, isn't it? I mean, you know,
absolutely.
Remember when Chuck Lesnik was involved, he was going to be doing the work of the indivisibles, and he was going to challenge the mayor to overturn the votes that were cast by the city council permitting the extension of term limits beyond the two to a third term. He evidently failed at that because he didn't do the job that he promised he would do. The question is, do you think that Chuck Lesnik's got the brains, or excuse the French, the balls, to even consider entering the race for mayor?
And now I don't really think so, to be honest.
Now that he's dissipated all the support from the Indivisibles because he failed them.
Yes, no, that's absolutely true. He led them. He said he was going to do it, and he didn't do it. Then it really to speak about his political future, because I don't think he has one, to be honest. Because once you put yourself out there, so out there and everything, and then you say you're going to accomplish this goal, and then you don't accomplish the goal, then really speaks to going forward. What kind of elected official will you be? Can anyone really support you when you promise you're going to?
Yeah.
Get this measure on the ballot, and it didn't happen.
Yeah, I agree. So that's going to be very, very interesting. What do you think the prospects are of Sabatino staying on and running for re-election? Because his term is up this year.
Yes.
So either he runs for re-election or he doesn't.
Yes. I don't know. I don't know. It should be interesting. I don't really know because I always thought because the term got extended that he was going to go for another term. It'd be interesting to see who if he does run, who does run against him.
Well, that's a real question, but I don't think he's going to run. I hear that he's looking to get a job somewhere, either with the city or to get a job at the county level. So the way I've heard it, this was for months now, that he wants to get a job someplace, and no one's offered him a job yet. So it's not like he's got, you know, an opportunity yet.
That's also true, yeah.
I really wonder, like, what could he do on the county level, you know, that they would want him for a position of some kind? That I can't see that for the life of me. And
I agree.
I swear to you, you know, to me, Sabatino is like a bull with tits. Who needs that? But the bottom line is, it makes no difference what he does. I mean, is he like a benefit to anybody on the city council? Because he did a really shit job, excuse the French, when he did the budget, when he led the budget last year. What a disaster that was. So I don't know what value it is.
I agree with you. It's really
to the public interest.
That's true. His time on the council has not been stellar. I'll say that it hasn't been stellar at all. To be honest,
that's a good word, stellar.
Because it really is.
Who's Stella? Who's good looking?
it should be interesting to see what happens here, because like I say, within this month to the beginning of next month, you know, we're going to have to start to hear some names here as far as people running. If some of these council members don't want to run for a third term, it'd be interesting to see who the like I say, it was always nice to have new blood on the council too, because new blood brings new energy.
Yeah. You know who I thought might consider running for the third district. You remember this guy who's the head of the auxiliary police in Yonkers, Steven Simpson?
I've heard of him.
You have heard of him? I like him very much. He's very open. You know, he's just open. You know, he doesn't have to play a game, a con game with anybody. So he tells you where he's at, tells you what positions he's at. Very, very involved and engaged in the community. I think he's a very powerful voice. At the same time, remember when Jose Alvarado was elected to the position of city clerk, and then he never showed up to work until like 3:30 in the afternoon when he was supposed to show up at 8:30. He used to do that. We outed him, and we drove him out. Thank God for that. But then he ended up getting a job at City Hall. But I wonder if he might be the one that might reconsider getting back into the position of Westchester County Board Legislator to succeed Virginia Perez.
because he used to hold that position before he became
clerk. Yes, he did. Yes,
remember that
for a long while. Yeah.
Right, and if he works for the city of Yonkers, but if he can hold on to that seat and the pay, and also get an additional $57,000 as a county board legislator, which he knows well, and he knows the community well, and it is also a minority district, I think he could do very well.
I agree. That would be very interesting. That would definitely be very interesting.
Boy, there's so much stuff happening in Yonkers. Who would have
so much stuff? Yeah, no, it's really interesting because also don't forget we got Yonkers mayor's race this year too. So you know we got all kinds of stuff this year. It's should be interesting to see how everything shakes out. And Yonkers, it's always interesting, and that's for sure.
It always is. Well, that is interesting. The mayor's going to run for a third term this November. Wonder when he's going to start his campaign effort, because we know that that's happening. Do you think that the budget process this year is going to affect positively or negatively to the outcome for the city? Because the state has to pass its budget by the 1st of April. Full days, it's April Fool's Day, no less. So they don't have to, but they try to meet that deadline. And that'll allow us to recognize how much funding the city of Yonkers will get. But that becomes another question. When do we finish our budget process? The end of March, is it? Or May?
Oh, yeah. Actually, actually closer to May, end of May, beginning of June, sometimes.
Oh, okay. All right. So
because sometimes always fighting for extra money just to make sure that, especially that we're going to, looks like we have a very bad budget deficit again this year. With that budget, hopefully there'll be help, but who knows? It's crazy, like we always talk about, they're not really talking about the budget right now. They're not really talking anything about the budget. They really should be planning. Planning is really the thing that really needs to be improved as far as the budget is concerned. We need better planning to be able to look at ways that we can save taxpayer money and to lessen the deficit.
Well, you know, last year when they approved the budget, there was a stall because they wanted to increase the remuneration of some people that were sitting there, you know, like in communications and stuff like that, which was absurd as all sin. But they were stalling the process because we were supposed to be getting, they wanted to increase somebody's salary by $10,000 here and this one there. I mean, it just went, it's just like, I can't believe that this is all happening, that's for sure. But, I don't know, what's your impression of the budget process? Because I found that it wasn't controlled by the city council. They didn't know how to decipher what was in the city in the budget. They may have asked questions, but I don't think, I was not impressed that their questions led to a conclusion of some sort that permitted the public to understand what their intention was by the question. And that lack of capacity on their part when they ask questions and not give us the corollary, which would have been basically an answer, is their failing. And I hope to God that we don't go through the same BS that we did last year, this year, because it's more critical this year than it was last year.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Because of the cost factor.
Yes,
absolutely.
Without a doubt, yeah, no, absolutely. That's why. Hopefully, this year's budget process is a lot better, and the council members, do more in terms of activity. And like I say, that's why it's important that they should be really bringing up the budget early, and not just waiting until May. like I said, the budget is the whole year. It's not just starts in May. It starts. It's 365 days a year, that budget.
Yeah. Well, that's a question, too. If the budget's going to be discussed this year, last year it was led by the budget chair, Michael Sabatino, with the talk about Sabatino not running again or getting a job on the county, or getting a job somewhere else, the man is ready to go out the door. Should he even be permitted to manage the budget?
That is a very good question, Hesley. Really, to be honest, that is a good question. He's leaving.
Because I try hard because I know I have you at the other end, so I know you know it all.
That is actually a good point. If he is going to leave, really, that is a good point, because if he's going to leave, he's a lame duck. What's he going to really do in terms of, because this is a very, very, this may be Yonkers' most very, very important budget year that they've ever had, because there could be a lot of major, major issues in terms of the budget. And if he's going to be leaving, maybe they should put someone else in charge of the budget committee if he is going to be moving on, because it's only fair.
Well, I think it is fair, because you have to be invested in the city.
Absolutely.
Rather than with one leg out the door, looking for a job someplace. If you're looking to go out and find your job, and leave us alone, because, you know what I find really disgusting in Yonkers is that too many people believe that Yonkers is simply a stepping stone for them, and they always leave Yonkersites behind. They step on
that's true, yes.
Move on. They make their money, and they don't even say thank you. They just leave. It's just amazing to me. I mean, I've never
absolutely
the demeanor blows my mind.
like you say, they almost use Yonkers like a stepping stone, and then they just move on, and that's it. I'm saying to myself, if you're a representative of Yonkers, then you should be. Yonkers should come first in your mind, and not the ways of using. Not ways of putting money in your pocket more and more and more. You know, to me, Yonkers should be first, because Yonkers, if you have a elected official who do the right thing in Yonkers, Yonkers really could be a great way to the city.
Well, I think we need to define what that greatness is, and we need to do a better job in defining it for the public so that we're all on the same page. And that,
absolutely.
I still believe, is a failure of the administration, because they do not reveal through their communication department enough so that we can actually chew on it. And I guess the most important thing is swallow, right? So, the bottom line is we just don't know where they're at, and they don't share it.
To bring out good news and stuff. That would be stuff to celebrate. It seems to me like that stuff gets hidden that should be celebrated. And like I said, the people say, well, here's something's happened. Here's something happened. That's a great thing. Those kind of things should be celebrated. But for some reason, they always try and hide good stuff. And to me, I think it's when you have good stuff, you promote it.
Well, I think you hit on the nerve, because the truth is we don't celebrate enough because it's not shared. And
you can't know
what's going on in somebody else's house. You could hope they're having a good relationship between husband and wife, the kids, everything is okay. But we don't know anything that goes on in our neighbor's home. We just don't. We just hope that it's similar to us, but we don't know if it is or it isn't. But that's the point. We need to understand what to celebrate and why to celebrate it.
Yes, that's true.
It's just not explained. It's interesting. We have a lot of economic development that's going on in the city. I swear to you, and I mean this seriously as God is my witness, I do not fully comprehend the incentives that are afforded through the IDA, not just in Yonkers, everywhere. In every community across the nation, how that pays off. I don't understand it. I've never heard it explained. I've always been told, well, it works, and maybe it does. But if it works, then why can't we explain it fully? Why don't we understand how it
That's
really
true,
works,
yeah.
when the payoff is, what the process is? Because I always
yes.
get the impression that we give them the incentive, we give them the go-ahead when we say you're authorized and authenticated to go and do this. So that's really terrific. And so that's cool, but that gives them the opportunity to go to a bank and get the loan. So what do we get out of that? Do we get a part of
that's
that?
That's also true.
And then
yeah, not true.
And then, you know, and I'm still disgusted that many times we give people developers of all kinds. Doesn't matter, not just for housing, but developers in businesses and stuff like that. We give them benefits because they claim they're going to employ a certain number of people. And then we find out instead of employing 50, they only employed 5. So why can't we pull
yeah.
that money back? That really bothers
and also,
me.
Yeah, it's very true. Like you say, Hezzy, it's a problem with the process because we don't really know, you know, they say they're going to bring in a certain amount of jobs and then sometimes doesn't turn out to be the case and everything. And like you say, if they don't fulfill their contract and everything with us and they don't bring the amount of jobs that they claim they're going to bring in, then we should get
yeah.
that money back because really it's I think the economic development process has been, you know, I think it's all over, you know, in terms of you don't really
it
know what
over.
The situation is because it's all about process. And That's something that needs to be improved. The process when it comes to economic development, how these things are worked out, what goes on, and everything. And if the developers don't bring in the job that they say they're going to bring in, then I think that should be a thing where they should have to give the money some of the money back to the city or municipality that they're doing in. Really something, because this is all supposed to help. This is supposed to help build our tax base and everything. And if it's not building our tax base and not helping the municipality or the city or the county or wherever, you know, it's not helping anyone other than the developer.
You remember there was a bridge out in California. I think there must have been an earthquake or something. I don't remember what it was, but the bridge came down, and they needed to rebuild it, so they paid. They paid somebody who was at the head of the construction. This is a few years ago, quite a few years ago. And so they paid someone to do it. And he ended up, and the incentive for him was the sooner you get it done, you'll get also money at the rear because they'll give him the incentive for having it done early. And you know what he did, which was really brilliant? He decided to not just work on an 8-hour shift or a double shift. He worked 24 hours a day. So he had 3 shifts, nonstop, 24 hours a day, reconstruction, bought stuff not just from California but from throughout the country and shipped it over there. And at the end of the day, I think he finished, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ahead of time that they even have contemplated, and he got a bonus for that. Well, you know what? So if we can give you money for doing the job right and to save us money at the end because you're doing such an eloquent job of it, then why can't we, if you're going to promise us something, why can't you deliver? And if you don't deliver, then why don't we get a chance to take back our money?
That's true. Yes, no, absolutely. That is very true. Really, it's fair because, like I said, when they do the project and they say they're going to bring this and that, if they're not bringing in what they say they're going to bring in, then really they're not fulfilling to their end of the bargain. We fulfill our end of the bargain by giving them, you know, tax abatements and other appeasements. But they're not coming through. And if they're not coming through, then they're not coming through on their end. And something has to come back to the taxpayers of that municipality and stuff. You know, it's really is crazy in terms of all these issues.
I'm sorry.
In terms of these issues, the problem is about those kinds of issues is, like, you do make a good point that, you know, if they're not fulfilling their end of the bargain, we should get some of that money back.
I think so, too. You know, just so you, I just noticed, because we're so immersed in our discussions, it's really insane.
Oh, okay.
It's like about 4 after 11. Do you have another few minutes to discuss something
sure,
more?
Sure, I do, yes.
Go? Oh, cool.
No, I'm okay.
About this other thing. For about 3 or 4 weeks now, I've been trying to find out. Actually, it started more like 2 months ago. I tried to find out there was a vehicle of some sort that came onto the Padilla School parking lot. We don't know what the vehicle was, but evidently it arrived at a place very close to an oil tank that was buried in the ground under this parking lot. And somehow, whatever the vehicle was, it collapsed right next to or adjacent to this well, this tank. So so I presume it was somebody delivering oil. But when I asked people about it, they didn't know. And initially, they allocated $100,000 to fix it because when the vehicle came to this place, it caused the parking lot to buckle, and they thought it would run about $100,000 to fix. Then it turns out later that they realized it was going to cost $58,000 to fix. Not a problem. It is what it is. So the city was going to pay for this month for fixing. But the thing that I couldn't understand is, since you get a vehicle, if you permit a vehicle onto the parking lot in the school, first of all, is there anybody there to check that this vehicle is authorized school property? Then every vehicle on the road is supposed to be licensed, right? And have insurance.
That's true. Yeah.
So
yes.
Who drove this stupid thing onto the parking lot? And then when I tried to find out the name of the company or individual that owned the vehicle that caused this calamity on the parking lot, nobody knew. So I asked some people to look into it at the Board of Education. They don't have an answer. Can you imagine the audacity? They don't have an answer. But my only question is, why are we as a city willing to pay the $58,000 to fix this thing, when in reality, shouldn't we be reimbursed by the people who came on the lot, who caused that problem? Because we didn't cause it.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah. They're the ones that caused it. They should reimburse us. We shouldn't be paying for it. They should be reimbursing us.
They're lucky, you know, if I was there, they're lucky. Not only would I force them to pay up front, but I would sue them if they didn't pay in time. Because you know what?
Sure.
They need to pay instantly. Because the bottom line
absolutely.
Is that they caused this problem and they needed to fix it. So
they're
lucky that we're giving an extension of money up front. But I didn't hear anybody mention that we're getting refunded. The money reimbursed for the money that has to be sent. And I wonder, why is it that in Yonkers we believe that the taxpayers' money is to use as any way they want, because they voted on this at the Yonkers Board of Education Board of Trustees. They voted okay on it.
Oh, boy.
They asked for the reimbursement.
Oh,
and then
boy.
They're waiting for me to send a FOIL into the Board of Education. The bottom line is they can go, you know what, because the bottom line is I'm going to write it when I have a time. I would discuss it now, but I'm so busy the rest of the week. Probably wait till next week to get an answer to write this article up, because I'm disgusted. Hey, it's the taxpayers' money. They have no right to spend it. And I want a reimbursement.
Absolutely.
I know it's $58,000
for
you
absolutely.
And me. It may be a lot of money for the city. It means absolutely.
It's not the taxpayer's fault. It's the person. It's the person who had this vehicle and everything. They should be the one reimbursing the city. We shouldn't be paying it out. They should be the one reimbursing us back for what happened.
Oh, and then you know the other thing is, God help them if the vehicle that came on is not insured, and God forbid. If that vendor, if it was a vendor and not an individual car, if a vendor came onto the school property and caused this issue, and they're not an approved vendor, and we didn't vet them correctly, and they're not insured. God help us, because you know what?
Yeah.
I'll take out a lawsuit against the city for that sort of bullshit, because they always say that they watch. There's always an oversight committee, but I am waiting for the oversight committee rather than to bury it. You know, the Board of Education, Board of Trustees never even mentioned it. It happened about 2 months ago. Never mentioned
it. Oh, boy.
I don't understand this.
So yeah, I don't understand it either, to be honest.
We celebrate the tragedies, and we don't celebrate the
We don't celebrate anything. You know, we don't like you say, we don't celebrate the tragedies, and we don't celebrate the success stories either. So, you know, that's the whole problem here. It really is the problem in whole miniature and everything.
I used to think maybe it was a problem in our drinking water, but I hear Yonkers has got the best drinking water around. So, it can't be the water. What is it?
It's a really good question. I don't really know, to be honest. It's just something. It's something that something goes on, and it just something goes on in our city. I don't know, really honestly, because like I say, if the vehicle did something, we don't have to pay for it. The person who had the vehicle should reimburse us. It's just simplistic, I think. But I guess nothing's simple in this town, I guess.
Well, we like to complicate it. Maybe that's part of our. That's part of who we are. We just love the drama. I don't know what it is about drama that just like is infectious somehow, and we love it. I mean, it's like an elixir. It's like
that's
the best drink in the world or the best meal. My God, we just love it. So. You know, Delphin, any other important issues that need to be discussed?
I think we have a really good discussion today on a lot of issues all around the block and everything. I think it was very, very good today.
Well, I think you're right. I think it's one of our best. I don't know. We keep getting better. I don't know if people can handle it.
I agree. We keep getting better with age, you know?
Oh, God, yeah, tell me about it. I'm getting older and older, Delphin. Don't you catch up with me, because stay young. Stay young, whatever you do. Well, Delphin, all the best to you. Thank you for
Thank you so much. You too. Always a pleasure to be with you on the show to discuss issues that matter to the citizens of Yonkers. Thank you so much, and have yourself a great day. You're welcome.
You too, sir. All the best.
You
well,
too.
There
Bye-bye.
It is. The final words from none other than Yonkers insider, publisher, editor, Delphin Musler, always in the know, always was one of the first people that ever came on the political landscape in publication, particularly with the new media, which was the blog at the time. I don't think the blog is a derogatory term. It was expressed that way because the newspapers were under assault and they knew it. And evidently, we're seeing it now, even 15, 20 years later, that they're all falling apart. The print media is dead. And they can try as best they can, but it's dead. And they're just going nowhere. And the numbers, that's the other thing. I should have asked Delphin about this. But the thing that's interesting is about that four people from the Journal News have been let go. One of them was Ernie Garcia, who is the who was a reporter, covered Yonkers, covered Pelham, covered Mount Vernon, and when he was let go, he got a job as the communication director of the Mount Vernon IDA. So we wish him well. There were three other much older people who worked for the Journal News. I think they had to be in their early 60s, maybe mid-60s. They were let go. The question is, how will the Journal News operate to satisfy the needs of Westchester County, 1.2 million people in Westchester County, and they don't have reporters quite a while for everybody to catch up with what's going on with Yonkers, that's for sure, and Mount Vernon. I think there are a couple of reporters that were covering Mount Vernon, and so we'll see where that goes. But the biggest issue is, as far as I'm concerned, the biggest city in the county, which is the 200,000 people who reside in Yonkers. And we make up 21% of the county. So that's not chicken feed. You know, this is really important stuff. So, you know, I just don't think they ever got it together at the Journal News, even when they did report on what was going on in Yonkers. They did have the inside scoop through some advertising and publicity firms that used to reach out to them because they would make more money, you know, by advertising in the Journal News. So that was their vehicle for making money. But the reality is, the public wasn't getting anything back for it, and they really should consider spending their money a bit more wisely and less expensively than the way they've done in the past. It really is absurd that we are wasting so much of the taxpayers' money when we can ill afford it and we can actually save money to do exactly what is being accomplished in the print media that is not conducive to the financial capacity of the city of Yonkers. And I would dare say not to places like Mount Vernon, Portchester. There are other poor communities that are struggling with deficits. Ossining has got issues as well. There are so many places that have problems. And why no one has gone beyond the old standard is beyond me. You know, they'll force us to go bankrupt while we're still sitting on our rear end, not contemplating what to do into a future that will be a little bit easier on the taxpayers' dime, because that's very, very crucial. So let me just quickly take a break, find out what's going on in our neck of the woods. Let's find out what they're doing at the Yonkers Tribune, and then we'll be back. One second.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a stenopad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. This is Westchester on the Level. If you want to reach out to the Yonkers Tribune, they have another number. You can reach them by text or by leaving a message on the phone. It's also the office number. The number is 347-415-4326. So 347-415-4326. Well, there is much to consider, but I guess one of the most pertinent issues, of course, going on between France and Germany. They are renewing their vows after the Golden Jubilee. So more than five decades after sealing their post-war reconciliation, France and Germany aim to inspire greater unity in a fractured Europe by further deepening their relationship, though the French have no plans to share their precious United Nations seat. French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Angela Merkel met today on the German border city of Aachen, known in France as Aix-la-Chapelle, to sign a new partnership between their two countries exactly 56 years after the Élysée Treaty, signed by their predecessors Charles de Gaulle, President Charles de Gaulle of France and Konrad Adenauer of Germany, who sealed the Franco-German friendship after World War II. In its own words, the new agreement, referred to in the French press as the Treaty of Aix-la-Chapelle, aims to, quote, deepen the two countries' cooperation in foreign affairs, defense, external and internal security and development, and at the same time work on strengthening the ability of Europe to act independently. In so doing, its proponents hope to breathe a new life into a partnership dubbed the Franco-German couple in France that has been a cornerstone of European integration and offset the centrifugal forces that are tugging at the 28-member European Union and amid mounting nationalism and Euroscepticism. So, populism and nationalism are strengthening in all our countries, Merkel told French, German, and European officials gathered in Aachen's town hall. She cited Britain's departure from the European Union and mounting protectionism around the world, acknowledging that international cooperation is on the back foot. Her words were echoed by Macron, who stressed the growing anger within European societies and pressure from without. Those forces were at play in the run-up to Tuesday's celebrations, blurring talk of the new treaty with one of the fake news controversies come a defining feature of our age. The row saw far-right leader Marine Le Pen and her supporters flood news outlets and social media with the reports France had agreed to, quote, share, end quote, its permanent seat on the United Nations Security Council with Germany, thereby relinquishing its great power, quote, end quote, status, which is a lie. It was a lie, as was the viral claim that the treaty would also see France hand over to Germany the territories of Alsace and Lorraine, the focus of frequent wars between the two nations. Perhaps conspiracy theorists had been reading about past treaties of Aix-la-Chapelle signed in 1668 and 1748 when French kings Louis XIV and Louis XV swapped territories with their foes on the other side of the Rhine. A city steeped in history and symbolism, Aachen was the capital of Charlemagne's 9th century empire, a vast territory that stretched over modern-day France and Germany and beyond, and is sometimes described as the embryo of a united Europe. It already hosted Macron and Merkel in May of last year, when the French president received the Charlemagne Medal in recognition of his vision of a new Europe. Merkel gave a speech in Macron's honor during the prize-giving ceremony, praising Macron's contagious enthusiasm for the European project. He has clear ideas on where and when Europe needs to evolve and has the capacity to inspire young Europeans, she said. France's most Europhile president in decades, Macron, had been hoping for more enthusiasm from the German chancellor when he first called for a new Élysée treaty 18 months ago. Since then, Merkel has been forced into a more prudent stance on European integration, alarmed by the rise of Eurosceptic forces in Germany and weakened by the laborious coalition talks that paved the way for her last term as chancellor. The wider context is also looking bleaker, with Brexit, Donald Trump's America, and mutinous Eurosceptic to Hungary all piling pressure on the European project. In recent months, France has been frustrated by Germany's reluctance to press ahead with a joint Eurozone budget and a common framework to tax digital companies. But if there is one thing both countries have mastered through decades of close partnership, it is the art of compromise. You can almost tell from the wording of the treaty where the French gave in and where Germany gave in, said Hélène Mialde Delacroix, a professor of history and contemporary German civilization at the Sorbonne University in Paris. There are so many issues on which the two countries are miles apart, so it's perfectly normal that they have to compromise. Mialde Delacroix says that finding common ground between two old rivals who fought three devastating wars between 1870 and 1945 was at the heart of the Élysée Treaty. She points to two areas where the treaty worked wonders and a third where it largely failed. Success stories include a binding framework for regular high-level meetings between leaders, ministers, and top civil servants that obliged both parties to take into account their respective constraints and objectives and strive to reach a common position. The other main achievement is an ambitious exchange program that has seen some 9 million French and German youths cross the Rhine over the years. The military cooperation did not work so well, largely because de Gaulle wanted France and Germany to stand up to the U.S., whereas the Germans were not prepared to do without NATO's protection. Soon after signing the 1963 treaty, the French president was shocked to find out that the German parliament had added a preamble reaffirming the country's special relationship with the United States. He infamously quipped, "Treaties are like girls and roses. They last while they last." Fascinating. What's interesting is that in today's world, under Trump, Charles de Gaulle would have been lauded as being the preeminent responsible leader in all of Europe because he wanted to undertake and make France the leader within the European Union with nuclear power and capability. So, oh my God, so... Anyway, France and Germany later agreed to form a joint brigade, which is now deployed in Mali in Africa, but it still has no mixed companies, and the two countries' different rules of engagement mean combat operations are largely left to the French. Different cultural approaches mean the two countries will also find it difficult to expand their cooperation in arms exports, an objective set out in the new treaty. Germany's decision to hold arms sales to Saudi Arabia after the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi has caused friction with the French government, which has had no such qualms. Now, Paris even threatened to pull out of the two countries' joint New Generation fighter project if Berlin insisted on sales restrictions. While France will in no way surrender its United Nations Security Council seat, treaty extension stipulates that it will be a priority of Franco-German diplomacy to secure another seat for the European Union's largest and richest country, a long-standing German demand. Now, critics have described this as an empty pledge, pointing out that permanent members China and Russia will not allow another Western nation to be added to the five members club. More meaningfully, the new treaty outlines closer cooperation between national intelligence services and police in fighting terrorism and organized crime, and a commitment to moving towards a French-German economic area with common rules. The aim is to remove obstacles to daily life across the border through convergence on labor laws, health services, and pension schemes, Miao Delacroix advised. Here, as in other fields, the idea is to be a source of proposals that could be applied on a European scale, she added to France 24, noting that Franco-German initiatives such as the gradual removal of border checks from 1984 have often spearheaded wider change across the European Union. It is not only Europe that has been inspired by Franco-German reconciliation and cooperation, but the wider world too, says Beatrice Agrand, the Secretary General of the Franco-German Office of Youth, the OFAJ, one of the most successful creations of the Élysée Treaty. Exchange programs fostered by OFAJ have helped establish an intricate web of relations that is unique in the world and envied by many in the world. She said that Balkan nations have been inspired by the Franco-German reconciliation, adding, quote, "I recently met Moroccan civil society activists who were interested in applying our model to relations with Algeria, and even South Korea academics have come to study our case with a future reunification of their peninsula in mind." According to Marion Gaillard, a historian and specialist of Franco-German relations at Sciences Po, Paris. The deep ties or fostered at the political, economic, and cultural level by the 1963 treaty are indeed unique. So she asks, why change the text? The original treaty was short, simple, accessible, and it offered a perfect legal basis to develop further links between the two countries, arguing that a whole new treaty really wasn't necessary. Gaillard acknowledged that the new text touched on themes that were necessarily absent from the original, such as the digital economy and the fight against cybercrime. However, she said the flexible framework of the 1963 agreement left ample space for innovations. So when the relationship between the two countries failed to progress, it was through, quote, lack of political will, and not because of the treaty's limitations. That's something that we have to find here in the United States, political will. The real purpose of the second treaty is to make a political statement at a difficult time for the European project, she argued, describing Tuesday's event as an old couple renewing their marriage vows. It won't change the way they live, but it has symbolic value. She added, the Franco-German couple has always functioned on symbols, and there's nothing wrong with that, provided they are then translated into concrete action. My God, I mean, it doesn't get better than that, and that is the simplicity of it all. Well, I see we're at the end of the day for us. Let me just quickly look. Tomorrow's Wednesday. I'm not quite sure who's on tomorrow. Looks like we don't have anyone at the moment for the 23rd, so I may just simply opt out from doing a program tomorrow, only because, unless something comes forward, but only because I've got so much of a backlog on my plate, I just don't know where to turn first. So that will only give me an extra more than just 2 hours, but it will give me much more time to catch up on so many things. It's 2 hours usually for the radio, and then there's an easy hour to two preparation, and then there's the write-ups on top of it. So it's always a five-hour project, which just consumes my day, but I just love it, and it's our way to reach out to you, and I hope you can enjoy it. I certainly do, and I hope it becomes relevant to you. So again, a thank you to Robert Keston for opening up the show. Also to Delphi Musler, who really we need to mark him down as our Tuesday co-host. And then the news that or the analysis that we covered with you today. So that's our story. Be well. Stay warm, whatever you do, and we'll speak to you probably not tomorrow, most likely on Thursday, when we return with the Driving Me Crazy crowd. And I'm not sure if Mayor Thomas will want to give us a call. We'll see. And that's the story. All the best. Take care and goodbye.